Golf Smarter number 455, published on September 23, 2014, is brought to you by our Golfers Mart. The Ryder Cup is happening this weekend, and a new book about one of the most shocking and memorable Ryder Cup weekends is the topic of this show. This free conversation with author Neil Sagabell on his new book, Draw in the Dunes, the 1969 Ryder Cup and the finish that shocked the world, is about 30 minutes long. But the complete and compelling unedited members-only episode is well over an hour. If you're a golf history fan, then you're well aware of the concession. Well, during the members-only version, we get into details on the origins of the Ryder Cup, the makeup and personalities of the 1969 teams, and how all the matches that weekend finished. I've posted a video of the historic concession on our blog, but there's so much more to the story that made it remarkable. To take advantage of hearing the entire show, be part of our global community of golfers who've joined Golf Smarter for members only. These listeners receive a complete, unedited episode every week. They have access to our entire archives and gain access to exclusive discounts like the one we're featuring right now for Game Golf. But if you're not sure about joining just yet, that's fine. But get this members-only episode right now for only $1.99 in our Golfers Mart at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
The 1969 Ryder Cup finish that shocked the world with author Neil Sagabell.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Neil.
It's good to be with you, Fred.
It's good to be with you. It's good to be here. It's very good to be here. I'll give you more details on that in a minute. Before we get started, though, I want to remind everyone of the last time you were on the show, episode 353 and 354 for your great book on the 1955 U.S. Open.
Yeah, thank you. It seems so long ago, but I guess it was only a couple years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it came out just in time for the 2012 U.S. Open that was played in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's right. At the Olympic Club. Right. And I think that's the fifth time that they played the Open there. And the first time, of course, was in 55 when Jack Fleck upset Ben Hogan in one of the greatest upsets in the history of the game.
And that's what prompted your book, The Longest Shot, right?
That's right.
And that book is still available on our website in our Golfers Mart. Congratulations. It's gotten great praise because it was a really entertaining and timely story. And that's what we're going to talk about today, because this weekend we've got the Ryder Cup happening. And you've gone back in history once again to flush out a story that may not have been a big story at the time. But the 1969 Ryder Cup, what you call the draw in the dunes.
Yeah, I don't think anybody – it was an unexpected week in 1969. This Ryder Cup was not what it is today. It had all the elements, really, that it has today, playing for your country, playing match play, playing with your teammates and for a captain. But it had been pretty one-sided up until that point, and America was winning a lot. And then we had these 1969 matches – which, when I looked into this, and also even based on what else I've read, this was one of the best Ryder Cups ever played. It was,
really?
And it's known, what people know it for is the ending, of course. And that's what caught my eye when I was thinking about writing another book, that famous ending with Jack Nicklaus and Tony Jacklin on the final green. But
no spoiler alerts. Don't give out the final ending. We're going to get there.
Okay.
But go ahead.
It was a great Ryder Cup, and it was a surprise to the American team that went over there. It was, again, a different era. It was a Great Britain team back then and not a European team. But it was a thrilling week, and it had everything – that you could want in a Ryder Cup that would make it exciting and great and suspenseful. There was and you know, there was some acrimony. So it was quite a dramatic week there at Royal Birkdale.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me tell you my story about reading your book. I just got back from a week vacation. I was going down to Mexico for a week and was going to read the book while I was there, you know, lay on the beach and read a book. How perfect can life be? And so I started reading it, and I started getting into the background of Tony Jacklin and how you set up who he was and how he became, you know, one of the first British players to really have an impact in the United States. I was really enjoying it, and I was just starting to get into 1969, and I also love the way you incorporate world history as place markers to what was going on to all your stories. And then just as I was about to get to the Ryder Cup, Hurricane Odile hit Cabo San Lucas, which was where I was, and we were right in the heart of it. And we got stranded. I'm a refugee of Hurricane Odile. It was an amazing and terrifying event, and it took us 3 days. We didn't get out until Wednesday. The hurricane was Sunday night, and so I didn't get to finish the book. So it's up to you, my friend, to tell me the entire story. I want to hear it now.
Well, first of all, Fred, I have to say I'm just glad you're back at home and that we're having this conversation.
Thank you.
You and your wife are safe, and you weren't injured, right?
No, luckily, none of the windows in the room we were staying in imploded like the rest of the resort. The resort that we were staying at was pretty much destroyed. I would be very surprised if they're open again for the Christmas rush. And there were people telling us. I talked to a couple of hotel managers. They were telling us that it could be 3 weeks to a month before they get any electricity. And you know, there was no water. There was no sewage. And the sewage was starting to back up in the street. And there was looting and rioting. And martial law was set. It got ugly really fast. But we luckily had each other and didn't get injured and were able to make it through it. And because both of us worked in media in the San Francisco area for a long time, we still have a lot of friends who are in it. And as we got off the plane in San Francisco, there was a news crew waiting for us. And so luckily they knew that I would be the guy who has a lot of video and photos of what happened. And so I will post, there's a news story from a local TV station. There's a news story, and I'll put it on our website as well to show our adventure, if that's what you want to call it.
That was quite an adventure. And actually, I saw it right before we started talking today, and I was just sort of aghast. and then I saw your email that said safely returned from Mexico, and I was so glad to hear that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Was that – I know we're going to talk about this book, but was that was that the most terrifying experience of your life?
Wow. How crazy is this that I have to think about it? A couple years ago, my wife was a victim of a car accident. She was a pedestrian hit by a car. And that may have been one of the more challenging things in my life. Because, you know, we later learned after it was all over and she made it and stuff, we later learned how close she was to not making it. But as something we experienced together, it was really frightening. It was there were definitely thoughts crossing my mind that I may not make it back to the United States. Definitely that thought crossed my mind. And I think it would have been much worse if any of the windows imploded in our place. They actually, the first room we were in, we were right on top of the beach. It was on the fifth floor of a six-story resort, and we literally were 30 yards from the waves breaking. And they, at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, we arrived Saturday night, and by 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, they had moved us to a different room in the complex because they said it was safe. And we're like, we didn't even know this was coming. We thought there was going to be rain on Sunday night. That was the forecast. There was going to be rain. And so we moved into a different room, and we later went back, and you saw on the video, you saw how we went back into that room, and it was, there was glass all over, and it wasn't like tempered glass. It was just, you know, little shards. I mean, little pieces of glass. It was shards of glass. And there was one person from our hotel who got very bloodied because the glass hit him and his wife broke her arm. But if the glass would have broken in our room, I think we would have freaked out a bit more than we actually did. But the sounds of it were incredible. We had 135 mile an hour sustained winds and 150 mile an hour gusts. And a lot of the construction there in that area, they use the Spanish tile roofing, and the tiles were flying everywhere, and they were crashing onto cars, and it sounded like, you know, bottles breaking nonstop. And then at about I'm from California. Give me an earthquake any day, right? It's a beautiful day. Oops, the ground is shaking. Okay, it's over, and it's still a beautiful day. The anticipation, they're saying it's coming, so the anticipation for hours drove us crazy. And then the hours of the hurricane terrified us. And then at midnight, it got quiet. And it was very, you know, calm. And then at 12:30, it picked up again. So clearly the eye of the hurricane went directly over us. So, yeah, to answer your question, it was pretty terrifying. Yeah.
I can't even imagine it. I know friends who've been through a hurricane, but I just can't. I wouldn't want to go through that. I'm sorry you went through it. I'm glad you're okay. And
well, I don't want to go through it again.
No,
I've been in Atlanta once and in Indianapolis once when tornado watch was happening, and we had to, you know, in Indianapolis we had to evacuate into a bunker underground, and that made me a little bit crazy. But nothing happened. And you know, a tornado, you can see the path of a tornado when, you know, when it does its destruction. But houses may get, you know, run right over, but the houses on the sides of it don't have as that kind of damage. An earthquake, most of the time on earthquakes, especially in Northern California, that's kind of built for earthquakes, that, you know, they're prepared for it. You have isolated instances. When we were in the 1989 earthquake, we were actually at Candlestick Park at the World Series. And when that occurred, we had, I think there were three major areas of destruction during that earthquake. And that was the Bay Bridge. We had just been on a half hour earlier. The Oakland area, the freeway that had collapsed, the MacArthur Freeway that collapsed, which we drove by that night and saw. And in the Marina District in San Francisco, the Ball of Fire, the fires that were in downtown. And we drove by those that night as we were leaving the ballpark. But here with the hurricane, it was everywhere. It didn't miss anything. And it went right. It surprised them. They thought it was going to go west and stay off land, but it came right up the middle of the Baja Peninsula and went up through La Paz. There was a tremendous amount of destruction. At this point, I understand they only have 5 confirmed deaths, which is really remarkable, but a lot of injury. And the rioting and the looting that took place and continued to grow until they had to declare martial law on Wednesday.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. But enough of that. I'm safe. I'm here and it's time for Golf Smarter. Thank goodness I get to do this again. I have this to do. So let's talk about your book, please. Draw in the Dunes, the 1969 Ryder Cup and the finish that shocked the world. So I'm going to just sit back and I want you to take it from the top and tell me, set up the story and then give it to me, please.
Well, without giving away the ending right off the bat, that was what caught my eye. And that was where I started looking into this. And I thought, why did that matter so much? Why that was that such a big deal? Why is it so well remembered? And why do we still see clips of it? And we'll probably see clips of it this week during the Ryder Cup coverage of Nicklaus and Jacklin on that final green. And so when I started researching this topic, I discovered what journalists called at that time the greatest Ryder Cup that had ever been played. And I think it's near the top of a lot of people's list even today. It was, in some ways, it resembles my first book in that you have a heavy underdog, the Great Britain team, and you have the Americans who have just been owning them ever since the early 30s. Great Britain's won once. They won in 1957 over there. And in the Ryder Cup that precedes this 1969 Ryder Cup, I go into that, and you've probably read that chapter. It's second chapter. It's called Champions. I thought it was important to set up the story, not only give the context of the era, but talk about what happened in 67 at Houston. And what happened was America won by 15 points, largest margin in the history of the Ryder Cup. Ben Hogan was captain of the American side. And this is without Jack Nicklaus. They didn't even have Nicklaus on the team.
Right.
Now, they had a lot of other great players like Billy Casper and Arnold Palmer. So, and 67 was also this young man named Tony Jacklin's first Ryder Cup as well. And he had a pretty good debut, even though his side got whipped pretty handily. So, in the early part of the story, I set up the what golf is like in this era,
right?
What it's like in America and what it's like in Great Britain. And now, you know, we see European players in America every week. They play on the PGA Tour. There are really no barriers to them other than their ability to play. But back then it was still very separate. And as you mentioned early on, Tony Jacklin was one of the few players from Great Britain that played on the American Tour. And it wasn't really a very welcoming tour in those days. It wasn't really set up for these foreign guys to come over and play. But Jacklin earned his way onto the tour. And this particular story, Draw on the Dunes, also chronicles his rise in golf. That year, he won the British Open in July, the first Brit to win the British Open in 18 years. So he's the star of his team heading into Royal Birkdale, one of the 12 men. And Nicklaus, interestingly, and this has been a topic for a lot of conversation I've been having since the book has come out, is playing his first Ryder Cup, even though he's a seven-year veteran on tour. And nine of his 11 teammates are also playing their first one. So you have a bunch of rookies. And the reason for that is the PGA of America back in that day had a stipulation that you had to be a PGA professional, a member, for 5 years before you were eligible to play on the Ryder Cup team. So Jack barely missed in 67. And now he's 29 years old. He's won seven majors at this stage in his career. Not quite 30 wins on tour, and he's playing in his first, as are 10 of his teammates. And you have five rookies on the Great Britain team. I know you've got great golf fans on your show who really get into this stuff, Fred. So I'm probably going into a little bit more detail than I do on several of my interviews, but the way the teams were determined in 1969, America was determined entirely on a point system. So the top 12 players in the point standings made the team. The captain was Sam Snead. People recognize that name.
Sure.
Sam had no picks, and I'm sure it was of no concern at all to him because America always won. You know, I think they probably felt like, whether they said it out loud or not, that they could go over there with any 12 and win.
And the press treated it that way as well, right?
It was almost a non-event over here because, you know, back in that day, it was probably seen more as an exhibition from the American side of things because, as I said earlier, it had all these great elements and all this great potential. And it was pretty neat and compelling when it started. But what it lacked was competition, competitive matches, it being close, it being exciting. That was missing. So, you know, there's so many things going on in 1969. It's a little bit, there are these little cultural things I put in there to remind people of what was going on then. The Vietnam War, Richard Nixon entering the White House, the moon landing with Neil Armstrong.
Making a comment about golf when he was on the moon.
That's right. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I found that in Golf Illustrated, which is a British weekly golf magazine. In fact, it's still around.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was a British publication.
Yeah. And in doing my research, I can just tell your audience, too, that a lot of it came from the other side of the pond because it just wasn't covered as heavily over here. It was probably relegated more to the back pages of the sports page. Now, it was covered. There were New York Times stories. There were some golf magazine stories. But it was very heavily covered in Great Britain, where they really loved their golf and they had high hopes for their boys, even though they lost. You know, in America that September, you're in the middle of a baseball pennant race. And the Chicago Cubs are looking like they're going to win the pennant, but they don't. And people who are baseball fans have heard this before with the Cubs.
Yeah, a couple times.
And that was the year of the Miracle Mets. And some people who were around will remember that when they surprised everyone, they won the pennant and then they beat the Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. So, you know,
Tom Seaver.
Exactly. So it's so many things happened that year. But as it turned out, it did end up being a pivotal year in the Ryder Cup because when they got to Birkdale, they had these great, exciting matches. The British guys played really well, and they had a very I don't know if you've gotten to this part yet, Fred, but their captain was a Scot named Eric Brown. Very fiery, competitive, win-at-all-costs mentality sort of guy. And he had been a Ryder Cup player and had actually won matches in an era when his side usually was losing. He was undefeated in singles, which was kind of an anomaly for guys on his side. And he brought a different attitude to the matches. He didn't bow to the Americans. He was like, come on, guys, we can play with these guys. We can beat them. And that was his attitude. And then you got kind of crusty, old school Sam Snead, who doesn't believe in things like conceding putts, which sets up our ending nicely, and who has captain twice before. He's been a captain twice before, and he's making his eighth appearance in the Ryder Cup, never lost, never been on a losing team, and there's never been a tie.
And so now we're set up to bring Jack Nicklaus and Tony Jacklin to the final green on the final day. Let's just go right there and tell us what happens.
So then we have the big moment. Jack grinds over this putt and he finally gets over it. And, you know, like the Golden Bear did when he needed one, he knocked it in. And then in that moment, he reached down and he processed all this sort of what was happening and what he realized, what was at stake, the fact that Jacklin's putt was for a tie, not a win, and the fact that with a tie, America retains the cup, and the fact that Tony Jacklin was a new British Open champion and a hero over there. And if he somehow didn't get that two-footer in, as Jack has said, it might kill his career. Jack somehow calculates all this in the moment.
It would kill Jacklin's career.
Exactly. It would kill Jacklin's career. Or it would do serious damage to him to miss a putt like that in on his home soil to tie the Ryder Cup. And Tony is resolute. He will tell you he would have made that putt, and I bet he would have.
Oh, sure.
And all his teammates.
He said it was a two-footer, right?
It was a two-footer.
Okay.
Give or take maybe a couple inches. But what all the players were unanimous on was he probably would have made it, but it was missable under the circumstances. It was not a gimme. If it were a gimme, then the concession really doesn't mean anything, and it wouldn't be the big deal it is today. So Nicklaus concedes the putt, and they shake hands. Jack has some nice words for Tony on that green, and they walk off the green arm in arm, the gallery's applauding. Henry Longhurst is announcing on BBC, and, you know, fade out. It was this great moment in golf. But as we talked a little bit of, I think maybe we alluded to earlier, it was controversial with some of his teammates and certainly his captain at that time.
Oh, sure. Sure. What was the relationship between Jacklin and Jack?
Well, that's an interesting part of it, too. I should say that one of the great, I mean, including spending time with them, a great part of this project for me, too, was asking and having them collaborate on the foreword for this story, which is in Draw on the Dunes. So the foreword of the book is by Jack Nicklaus and Tony Jacklin. And in that, they say, and you know, how they were friends. They were friends. And this is the interesting thing about Jack Nicklaus. He's this great competitor who would play to win and won a lot, but he also had this maturity about him and this grace to where he did something on that green that I don't know if any of the other players would have thought of to do, and that was to concede that putt. And he felt like that was the right thing to do, and that the Ryder Cup ending in a tie was a good thing. And I think he turned out to be right about that. Although, you know, people are certainly, it's debatable. You know, I've been asking the question in social media and elsewhere, you know, and Sam Snead didn't believe in giving a putt like that someone could have missed. They still could have won. But I think for the Ryder Cup and for reviving interest, for tapping into that spirit of sportsmanship, I think is a part of how the whole thing got started with Samuel Ryder, the international goodwill. I think that what Jack Nicklaus did was indeed a great gesture, and I think that's why it's still remembered and talked about today.
It's an amazing story. I am so glad that you dug it up and flushed it out the way you have. It really is a phenomenal story. What is there a record of how Sam Snead felt about the concession? Knowing that he wanted to win as the captain?
Yeah, there is. He never liked it.
Wow.
And I talked to Jack about that. Jack knew it. The other players knew it. Of course, Sam died in 2002, so I was never able to talk to him. But there is a quote in the book, in the aftermath chapter, that's attributed to Sam. That was, I picked up from another source, and it's a well-known quote. I've seen it in other places, where he said, we didn't come over here. It's something like, and I don't have it handy right now, but it's something like, we didn't come over here to be good old boys. And I would never give a putt like that to anyone except maybe my brother. That's the gist of it. He did. It just went against his philosophy. And Jack understood that. He told me when I interviewed him last year, he said, you know, that was just Sam's mode. He said, I accept that. Sam was a great player and a great competitor. He said, now, I don't know that when it was all over and it was a tie, I don't know that I felt like he should have been as upset about it as he was. But the Sam, you know, the captain and the players, even then, even with their disappointment, I think they had a lot of respect for Jack Nicklaus, because Jack said Sam never said a word to him about it. Not one word. Yes. At that time or until he died, Sam never said anything to him. And Jack's teammates never took him aside and said, Jack, what were you thinking? Why did you do that? They were, you know, they admitted they were disappointed. Tommy Aaron told me that. He said, I was shocked. Billy Casper told me that. He said, we were disappointed at the time. But he said, you know, they all eventually got to a place through the years where they could look back on that and say, that was a good thing. And that was a good thing for the Ryder Cup.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you for this story. This, and thank you for bringing it out as much as you have. I appreciate it, because I know you want people to read the book, but I think a tease like this is going to make them want to pick up this 280-page book and read it, especially this week, you know, to put it all in context with watching the Ryder Cup. What do you think is your next project?
You know, I don't know.
Really?
I don't know, Fred, but I hope there is another one, because I really enjoyed this. And one thing I, you know, we started talking about the players, and I really got off on the American team. But I think one of the things, too, that people will like about this is the British players are not as well known, but you get to know them in this book. So
absolutely.
People know of Tony Jacklin, but some of the other players that they'll meet in this story, they may have heard of, they may have known that they were captains at one point. One player in particular that a lot of people who are golf fans will know, he's still around, is Peter Allis, the great commentator for the BBC. He is in this Ryder Cup. It's his last one on the British side. And you have some other great players like Neil Coles and Christy O'Connor. Of course, I mentioned Brian Huggett. So I think Brian Barnes, some people might recognize that name. So I think getting to know the players was a lot of fun. And I didn't know the British side as well until I interviewed them and wrote about them. But I hope to do another book. And if anybody has some ideas, send them my way.
Will do. Send them to me and I'll make sure that Neil gets them. That's a great way to go. Well, the video of that final hole is available, and I will put that on the website as well to tease you just a little bit more about this story.
That's great.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's great. And I got right to the 18th hole with Nicklaus and Jacklin coming down to the end. But there are some things that happen in that final half hour, 45 minutes that are pretty amazing, and people will get into them. There's a player who thinks he has a putt to win the Ryder Cup before Jacklin and Nicklaus get to that final green, and he has good reason to think that. There's a lot of drama in that final hour of the 1969 Ryder Cup, and I detail that in Draw in the Dunes.
Awesome. Well, again, it's Draw in the Dunes, 1969 Ryder Cup, and the finish that shocked the world by Neil Sagabelle. Neil, I not only appreciate you alerting me that this is happening and getting it to me before the book came out to the public. Unfortunately, bookus interruptus by a hurricane. But I hope everyone comes to Golfers Mart on our website and go into our book section. You will find this, and you will find Neil's other book about the longest shot. Neil, it was great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time, and I look forward. I hope it's not another 2 years before we get to tell another story.
Me too. I really enjoy it, Fred. Thanks for having me on, and enjoy the Ryder Cup, and I hope the U.S. can win this time.
Listen, now that Neil's offline, there's a crazy epilogue to my harrowing days in Cabo that I needed to share with you. If you remember, I mentioned I was headed down to Mexico, that I was going to be playing the one and only at the Palmia. I had my round scheduled for Tuesday. I'd been communicating with their general manager and their director of marketing. In fact, we were exchanging emails till a few hours before Hurricane Odile struck the area and we lost all the power. Well, clearly I didn't get to play, but we will get someone from that course on the show when communication is restored, because I'd like to hear how they're dealing with that crisis and what damage they incurred. Well, as I usually do on vacation, I play just once. Maybe I play twice, but usually only once. I was so rattled by this storm and its aftermath that as soon as we got home on Friday night, my wife and I both agreed that we really needed to bring some normalcy, some sense of normalcy back in our lives. And for her, that's like nesting around the house, cleaning up, just hanging out. For me, it was being on the golf course. So I played first thing Saturday morning after I returned with my best friend, and we played at Indian Valley here in Novato. Indian Valley only has one flat hole. I decided I was too tired to walk the very hilly 7 miles that we took out a cart. What happened next was crazy and magical. Number 9 and 10 are both severe downhill tee shots. When we got to number 9, I was 2 over par, which is good. I was playing well. I was sinking the short putts that have been tormenting lately, and not getting too excited about anything and not overamped about anything. Anyway, so when we got to number 9, I pulled out the driver, which always tempts the end of the fairway when I hit it well there. But this time, I drove over the fairway and into a gully of very deep rough that's about 8 feet below the surface of the green. I can hear in my head another friend that I play with regularly saying, "That's too much club for you. Put the driver away." Well, his voice continued to get louder and louder as I struggled to find the ball in that gully. Just as I was about to give up, I stepped on the ball, and it was covered in 5 to 6 inch grass. Luckily, the flow of the grass was headed toward the green. So I pulled out my 60-degree score golf wedge and took a firm but easy swing. The ball landed softly, rolled, hit the stick, and dropped in for an eagle. Now I'm back to par after 9 holes. Next, on number 10, another severe downhole. It's about 300-yard par 4 with a blind tee shot to the green. Easily 100-foot drop between tee to green and probably more. Anyway, for the first time ever, I launched the drive and it plugged the green on a fly. Again, it took me a couple of minutes to find it because we didn't think that little white thing was actually a ball. But when I got close, I realized it was the top third of the ball. It plugged so deep. So after a good lag, you know, cleaned it up, fixed the divot, then I had a good lag putt and a 5-footer. I birdied number 10. So now I went eagle birdie on 2 consecutive holes. Crazy! But of the 5 bogeys of that day, 3 were on par 3s. Anyway, I ended the round with an all-time low score of 74. Just 2 over for the day. Hurricane? What hurricane? It was amazing. Hey, some good news if you're on the fence about getting a game golf for yourself. That discount being offered to Golf Smarter members has gone so well that John McGuire has authorized us to extend the discount to November 1st, 2014. Then that's it. Never again. There's not going to be any more discount. So you better act now. Now, the other day we had some friends over after we got back. This was planned well in advance. We had some friends over from out of town for dinner. Luckily, he was a golfer, lifelong golfer, so the conversation continued about golf and our week and golf and golf and my day. So I had to turn him on to the game golf. He listened with great interest and finally said, "So how has the game golf helped your game? And how will that improve my success at those damn 40-yard shots?" I thought about it for a while. How did it help my game? I explained that the information and statistics provided by my game golf unit helped me eliminate the 40-yard shot by, one, making better club selections, and, two, by reviewing my approach shots outside of 100 yards. And you can get that specific. You can get even more specific than that. I learned that I'm landing 40% of my shots inside 15 yards. These approach shots outside of 100 yards. 40% of them are coming inside 15 yards. But 33%, a third of my shots outside of 100 yards, are coming up short. And only 6% are going long. So now I'm taking an extra club for most approach shots, and I'm getting better results. All this is because of the stuff I've learned from using the game golf. If any of this rings true for you too, then you should seriously consider getting a game golf for yourself. Remember, Golf Smarter is the only place that you can take advantage of this additional off of the newly lowered price of $199. So the new price is only what? You only have till November 1st to click on Game Golf Ad on the homepage at golfsmarter.com and make sure you use the checkout code to secure the discount. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.